This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. John Bolton has served under three Republican presidents, Ronald Reagan, Bush 1, and took his highest-ranking position in the current administration. His tenure as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations was short, a little bit more than a year, and controversial. His suggestion to lop off the top 10 floors of the U.N. Secretariat building was not favorably received in the corridors of the international body. But while critics describe his often blunt language as undiplomatic, John Bolton did help convince the Security Council to issue sanctions against North Korea and Iran, and made progress on the issue of U.N. reform. Today, John Bolton continues to write and speak as a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, just as candidly. John Bolton is our guest this hour. He'll take your calls. Later in the program, an argument that today's immigration rallies attracted smaller crowds not because of frustration, but because of success. But first, John Bolton. If you have questions about Ambassador Bolton's time at the UN, the long effort to constrain the nuclear ambitions of Iran and North Korea, Darfur, or UN reform, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ambassador Bolton joins us from the studios of the American Enterprise Institute, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Glad to be here.
And I have to ask you, when President Bush appointed you to the UN, did anybody from the White House or the State Department suggest, John, you might want to dial it down just a little bit?
No, not at all. I think in America, plain speaking is a virtue, and I think the UN needs more than a little bit of plain speaking.
To your critics, though, what you call plain speaking sometimes sounded like contempt for the United Nations.
Well, I think when you talk about the problems of the organization to a complacent group of people, it may be unpleasant to hear it. But let me give you one example. While many people in the United States, strong supporters of the UN, opponents of the UN, were quite concerned about the oil for food scandal and the implications of that episode for the UN's effectiveness and the steps that would be needed to reform the UN, people at the UN didn't want to talk about it at all. I remember one negotiation in September of 2005 where one ambassador from a third world country objected to saying, "oil for food scandal." He said, "What was the scandal?" So you can see in that kind of environment that talking about problems may not be well received.
So that tactics that some critics described as a disruptive or confrontational, you saw as an effort to change things.
Well, I wouldn't describe them as confrontational. I think unless you're afraid of being confronted with the truth, and the truth is sometimes painful, but I think if you're going to reform the UN to make it effective, if you're not willing to confront the truth, ultimately you're not going to succeed in reform.
Mm-hmm. After serving there for a little bit more than a year as U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations, has your opinion of the world body changed? Is it a useful agency?
Well, my opinion hasn't changed. I've been dealing with or studying the UN for over 25 years, so I was privileged when I began my tenure up there to know a good deal about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned since then, I think, confirmed much of what I had seen beforehand, and that many of the notions and ideas that I had had based on earlier experiences were often confirmed by experiences during the 16 months I was up there.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. If you have questions for Ambassador John Bolton, the former United States Permanent Representative to the United Nations, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Bruno. Bruno's calling us from Chicago.
Yes. I'm interested to know whether or not the criticism of the Bush administration is accurate, that it's all war and all military and all threat and no diplomacy. And I'm speaking specifically of whether or not there have been some back-channel conversations with the Iranians, whether the Iran situation is close to being resolved or can be resolved without any more saber-rattling, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. Thanks, Bruno. And Ambassador Bolton, as I'm sure you know, there's a meeting scheduled in Egypt where the United States and Iran are both attending a broad meeting. this week, later this week.
Right. Well, I don't know what will happen at that meeting, but certainly the Bush administration, I think, has had a long string of diplomatic successes in a range of areas. For example, going back to the very beginning of the administration, we successfully negotiated with the Russians to extricate ourselves from the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972 that many people predicted would be the collapse of all of the existing arms control regimes. That has not happened. Subsequently, we negotiated the Treaty of Moscow, which will result over a 10-year period in a two-thirds reduction of operationally deployed strategic nuclear warheads. We negotiated the Proliferation Security Initiative designed to interdict the illicit international trafficking in weapons and materials of mass destruction. Now over 60 countries have subscribed to the principles underlying the Proliferation Security Initiative. Within the G7, we negotiated the global partnership against the spread of weapons and materials of mass destruction to help fund through international contributions the elimination of Russia's remaining weapons of mass destruction. I mean, these are examples of very effective diplomacy by the Bush administration, and the list could go on and on. So I don't think there's anything to the argument that the Bush administration is not prepared to engage in diplomacy when diplomacy can be effective.
You were talking about the former Soviet Union with Russia, and as I'm sure you also know, recently the issue of missile defense, the installation of U.S. The prospect of installation of U.S. facilities in Eastern Europe has caused the Russians now to threaten to pull out of the Conventional Forces in Europe agreement, a very important treaty.
Well, look, that treaty was negotiated during the Cold War between two opposing alliances, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. Today, most of the Warsaw Pact countries are members of NATO. So the treaty is out of date. I think its usefulness is over. And, you know, frankly, one reason that the Putin threat to suspend the Russian compliance with that treaty, one reason it has not aroused more controversy is because the treaty is fundamentally irrelevant.
Let's get another caller on the line, and let's go to Donald. Donald's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. I just wanted to find out if the ambassador had any thoughts what the advantage or disadvantages would be and the ramifications if we were to pull out of the UN, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Donald.
Well, I don't think there's any serious prospect that the United States is going to withdraw from the UN, so it's not a calculus that gets you very far. I do think that one conclusion I draw from my time in New York is that efforts at incremental or marginal reform of the UN are not going to be successful, and that what we really need to do is focus on the one single reform that I think can make a difference in the organization, and that is to shift from the current funding system, which is called assessed contributions, where the UN budget is calculated, and then currently the U.S. has billed 22% of that budget, 27% in the case of peacekeeping. I think we should move from a system of assessed contributions to a system of voluntary contributions. That is to say, each year the U.S. would decide how much we were going to contribute. It would decide what percentage of the budget we were going to fund rather than being assessed at our current level of 22%. This is based on the principle that we should pay for what we want and that we should insist that we get what we pay for. I don't think that's really a revolutionary principle, although it would be considered revolutionary in the context of the UN. That, I think, is the direction we should go in while we are members of the organization.
Pretty difficult if you're an administrator at the United Nations to make budgets year to year without knowing how much money you're going to get.
Oh, I think it would have a profoundly positive impact on the management of the UN because it would mean that managers would have to deliver, wouldn't it? Because if they didn't deliver, maybe they wouldn't be funded the next year. Indeed, the historical experience with agencies of the UN system that are currently funded by voluntary contributions, organizations like UNICEF, the High Commissioner for Refugees, the World Food Program, I think there's broad agreement that those are among the most transparent, best-run, most effective UN agencies because the managers know that if they don't deliver, governments can take their money elsewhere. So I think breaking the entitlement mentality within the UN Secretariat and within the UN membership could only have a positive impact on performance.
Let's talk now with Matthew. Matthew calling us from Philadelphia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's
sure.
Really hard to get through to you guys.
That's okay.
My question for you, Mr. Bolton, is, as a lifelong diplomat, you've chosen to be extremely undiplomatic when dealing with other diplomats. Do you think that being undiplomatic has been effective for you and the administrations that you've worked for? I think they've been extremely not helpful.
Well, I don't think I've been undiplomatic, and if you care to give me a specific example, I'd be happy to try and address it.
Sure. Well, for instance, your time at the UN, you were appointed there with a recess appointment because nobody wanted you there. And with all due respect,
can I just answer that? Can we do this one at a time?
Yeah, sure.
The Senate never gave me a vote because of Democratic opposition, but. Joe Biden, for example, currently the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, said that if there ever had been a vote on the floor, that I would have gotten 57 or 58 votes to confirm. So it's not that nobody wanted me there. It's that nobody got a chance to vote on it. What's your next point?
Well, my point to follow you up is that if there was a vote, I feel like the American people would have stood up and made you unappointable. My next point is, that while at the United Nations, you did your best to try and throw a wrench in everything that you were you were involved in. Now,
would you care to give a specific example?
A specific example? Well, was there ever a positive aspect that you found yourself in at the United Nations?
Certainly. I think I would give as an example Security Council Resolution 1695, which imposed sanctions on North Korea after their launch of ballistic missiles on July 4th of 2006, Resolution 1696, which ordered Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment activities in order to allow negotiations to proceed, Resolution 1701, bringing a ceasefire in the war between Israel
Ambassador,
and Hezbollah.
I know you
1706,
go on, but we're running.
I could go on for a while, too.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, Gustavo Arellano joins us. He argues the reason Latinos won't come out in full force at demonstrations today has nothing to do with disappointment. It's because of success. But right now, John Bolton is our guest, the former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Here's an email from Alan in Cleveland. I happen to be one who admired Ambassador Bolton's outspokenness in an otherwise obfuscatory culture at the UN. I would like to hear his thoughts on why the UN has been so obsessed with Israel and why other conflict areas around the world tend to be ignored or minimized in comparison.
I think that the UN is a focal point for a lot of countries to try and create facts on the ground. This was something that Yasser Arafat, during his lifetime and as head of the PLO, was really an expert at. He refused to negotiate with Israel for decades. And what he would do would be to try and drum up support for the PLO in capitals all over the world and in New York. So in a sense, this is one of the reasons I used to characterize the UN compound on First Avenue as a kind of twilight zone, that the people acted as if they could create a political reality in the UN without really dealing with facts on the ground in the region. And so that has been something I think U.S. policy over Democratic and Republican administrations has tried to break through, specifically in the case of Israel and the Middle East, to get the Arabs to negotiate directly with Israel. This was one of the accomplishments of the Bush 41 administration in creating the Madrid process. And in trying to break people of the habit that by posturing in the theater in New York, that you could really affect the reality that people dealt with in the region as a whole.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the situation in Darfur, where the United Nations has been on the sidelines, I think it's fair to say, for any number of years, does inaction on a situation like that make you frustrated with the capabilities of this institution?
Well, I think it shows that as long as you have a an organization that prizes consensus above all else, as the League of Nations did, that you are condemning it to a sidelines role. In the case of Darfur, we passed a resolution, 1706, one of the list I wanted to enumerate for your earlier caller.
I apologize, we were running out of time there.
No, it's quite all right. But that was an example, I think, of a very strong resolution that would have transferred peacekeeping responsibility in Darfur from the African Union force to a UN force. And after passage of 1706, the government in Khartoum just flatly refused to cooperate with the UN, refused to allow even evaluation missions to go in to plan for the transition, insisted it wanted an African Union force there on a full-time basis, and basically since that has just simply prevented the UN from getting in. And the reaction of other UN members has been that without the consent of the government of Sudan, the UN can't do anything. What that means is that when a government with a record of genocide like the government in Khartoum can frustrate the UN, the Security Council's resolutions are devalued. And so it's no wonder that governments like North Korea and Iran also ignore those resolutions. This is one of the paradoxes of dealing with the UN, where the UN's strongest supporters, like some of your earlier callers, mm-hmm. won't stand up for its own resolutions.
Getting back to Darfur, there's always been speculation. The United States never put forward a straightforward resolution on Darfur because of fear of a Chinese veto. Is that accurate?
No, that's not accurate at all. I mean, I was speaking of criticism of John Bolton. I was often criticized by some of our European friends, because I used to like to introduce resolutions that said, this is what we want. This is exactly what we want. Whereas their style was to propose resolutions that weren't quite what we want, but they hoped would be adopted without further compromise. Now, inevitably, we compromised even away from those drafts. But I was never afraid of Chinese or Russian vetoes. In fact, there were occasions when I would have pushed not on Darfur necessarily, but in the case of North Korea or Iran, I might well have pushed for a vote on a resolution just to see if the Russians and Chinese actually had the spine to veto it. That's one way you push the debate forward in the UN, and an unwillingness to do that often leaves you with a much less satisfactory outcome, in my judgment.
Well, why didn't you do it on China, on Darfur?
Confusing to a lot of people, supporters and opponents of mine alike, but I followed my instructions when I was in New York.
From Washington, in other words.
That's where they come from.
Yeah, okay. Let's get another caller on the line. This is John. John with us from Half Moon Bay in California.
Thank you, Pat, for having me in.
Sure.
Sir, thank you for your service to our country. Say, when you're negotiating with, say, the Iranians over whether they should have nuclear weapons or not to pursue their program, how do you address their concerns when they bring up maybe they've been invaded by the Russians and the British, they had a democracy that wasn't supported, they were invaded by the Iraqis who dropped chemical weapons on them, who's admitted the Americans actually supplied them with intelligence to how to more effectively drop those chemical weapons on them, and then no one seems to have really come to their aid on any moral issue. They've only been able to control their own destiny in the last 30 years or so since the Islamic Revolution. How do you address their concerns in history when they when you're talking to someone like that?
Well, in the first place, even if I agreed with many of the elements of your question, which I don't, that doesn't justify Iran from seeking to acquire nuclear weapons capability. Or perhaps you think it does justify that effort.
Well, we would do it if we've been invaded multiple times, if our government had been overthrown, whether we agreed with that government or not, as a patriot. Would we not?
May I ask you a question?
To make sure that never happened again.
May I ask you a question? Do you think countries that undertake treaty obligations should abide by them?
You mean like countries who say they're not going to develop missile defense shields, or who are going to reduce their atomic and nuclear arsenals?
Yeah. Well, I'll be happy to address both of those. Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapons state, and it undertook that obligation voluntarily. So if it's seeking nuclear weapons, which I think it is, then it's doing so in violation of its of treaty obligations that it undertook. In the case of missile defense, which you mentioned, the United States did exactly the right thing. We did want to develop a limited national missile defense capability, so we exercised the plane option available under the 1972 ABM treaty and gave notice of withdrawal. We didn't do anything in violation of our treaty obligations, unlike the Iranians.
Can they draw from their treaty obligations, and in which government actually signed those treaty obligations? Was it the Islamic Republic, or was it the puppet government of the Shah? How did they actually get into that treaty?
The current government of Iran has acknowledged that it's bound by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So if they are, in fact, seeking nuclear weapons, they're in violation of their treaty obligation, no matter who signed the treaty.
Well, can they cut out of it? Can they do the same thing? Can they abrogate the treaty the same way we
are? Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And if
then there'd be no issue with them. We wouldn't be putting pressure on them. We'd understand their legitimate right to self-defense and pursue their own interests the way they see fit.
No, you would say, though, at least at that point they were being honest, which they're not being now. I think that their pursuit of nuclear weapons has been something they've been pursuing for 20 years. They've concealed data from the International Atomic Energy Agency. They've lied to the IAEA. They've destroyed buildings and bulldozed hundreds of cubic yards of dirt to try and remove evidence of radioactivity. There's no doubt from publicly available information what the Iranians are up to, and that's one of the reasons why I think they are such a threat to the non-proliferation regime as it currently exists around the world, and why we need to take very strong action to prevent them from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Here's an email from Saeed in Arkansas. Ambassador Bolton talks about moving to voluntary contributions by the member countries. Would he then support the premise that the UN would have the right to decide our influence over that body or even the Security Council based on contributions?
Well, the question now is how much influence we have as one vote among 192 in the General Assembly. And yet we pay, so we're 0.5% of the voting authority of the General Assembly, and yet we pay 22% of the budget. So if you're going to do it on a $1 one vote basis, we ought to have 22% of the vote. The Security Council is an institution created by the Charter of the UN. It created five permanent members with the right of veto in 1945, and that's something that we have without regard to what our level of contributions is.
Is that another area of reform that you think is ready, that other countries might want to be included in that?
Well, I think a lot of other countries want to be included in it. This has been something that's been the center of attention for 15 years, and for 15 years there's been no change because there's no broad agreement within the UN who ought to be added as permanent members. And I might add there's no agreement whatever that anybody ought to be dropped.
Let's go to Murph. Murph with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, great show today, guys. And Mr. Bolton, with your vast knowledge of what's going on in the world today, simple question, but hopefully a good one. What keeps you up at night?
The proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in countries like Iran and North Korea, and frankly, the views of some people in this country that don't, like one of the previous callers, that doesn't seem to appreciate what a grave threat Iran and North Korea pose. These are not threats like in the Cold War, where a massive nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States would have eliminated civilization as we know it. These are not military weapons in that sense. They are weapons of terror that can be used against innocent civilian populations, our population or those of our friends and allies. And it's not enough to say that if North Korea gets a ballistic missile capability and is able to land a nuclear warhead on a West Coast American city, it's not enough to say, well, we'd retaliate and destroy North Korea. Or if Iran were able to put two or three nuclear weapons and create a nuclear holocaust in Israel or drop a nuclear warhead on a Western European capital, it's no comfort that we could retaliate massively. Once the weapon of mass destruction is used, once that horror is unleashed, the damage and the death that it causes can never be called back. That's why our priority has to be to stop these states from getting the weapons in the first place.
Would that also tie into the nuclear weapons that are still somewhat unaccounted for from old Russia?
Well, I think the Russians have theirs under control. I worry more about a place like Pakistan. If there were an Islamic revolution in Pakistan, if the Musharraf government were to fall and you had a radical Islamic regime there, or the government of Pakistan lost command and control over its existing nuclear weapons and they fell into the hands of terrorists, if North Korea sold a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group, there are a number of ways in which terrorists or rogue states could use these weapons. And as I say, the catastrophic impact of a nuclear weapon or the lesser but nonetheless horrible consequences of the use of chemical or biological weapons is something we need to spend more resources to prevent and have a stronger international presence, not a weaker one.
Thanks for the call, Murph.
Appreciate it, guys.
Okay, we're speaking with John Bolton, the former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ambassador Bolton, as well you know, Israel, India, and Pakistan are all nuclear powers as well. What makes Iran and North Korea different?
Well, not all nuclear powers are equally threatening. I think clearly it would be desirable if we had fewer nuclear powers than more. But let's just take the example of Iran, where you have a president, Ahmadinejad, that has called on Israel to be wiped off the face of the earth, that has denied the existence of the Holocaust, who has sponsored conferences with names like The World Without the United States. So when you see Iran moving inexorably toward a nuclear weapons capability, you have the classic strategic concern of a marriage of capability and intentions, clearly stated intentions and demonstrated capabilities. That's the kind of threat that I think we should be a lot more concerned about preventing from coming to pass.
Here's an email we got from Richard. I found your Financial Times article of the 9th, and this was how Iran probed, found weakness, and won a triumph, published in the Financial Times. He described it as incredibly refreshing. Your analysis of Iran's increase in relative power regionally and globally is fascinating. Could you please elaborate?
Well, I think Iran is pressing to expand its influence in its region and around the world in basically three ways. First, by this effort to acquire deliverable nuclear weapons capability, completely indigenous mastery over the nuclear fuel cycle so that they alone can determine when and the circumstances in which they might use nuclear weapons. That's one category. Second category is their interference inside Iraq, their effort to prevent the people of Iraq from establishing a peaceful civil society with institutions of representative government. It's reflected, I think, by increased Iranian activism among Shiite populations elsewhere in the region and around the world. And then the third category of activity, Iran's aggressive support for international terrorism, what Secretary Rice likes to call the central banker of international terrorism, funding Hezbollah in Lebanon to the tune of over $100 million a year, funding Hamas in the occupied territory, supplying weapons to these groups and others. This is clearly a government that has very aggressive policies it's pursuing, and in all of these areas, it poses a direct challenge to the civilized world as a whole and to the United States and its friends and allies in particular.
Mm-hmm. You've read all the opinion polls that people take in countries around the world, and the United States is held in perhaps the lowest regard any time since the end of the Second World War when these kinds of polls have been taken. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I don't agree that it shows that the U.S. is held in the lowest esteem. If you look at polls during the Vietnam War, for example, if you look at public opinion in Europe in the mid-1980s when we wanted to deploy intermediate-range nuclear missiles, there are always a lot of complaints about the United States. And I don't dispute those who say that our public diplomacy can and should be a lot better. But the fact is that the United States has a responsibility to itself and its friends and allies to act in its national interest. And it's less important what public opinion polls say about us than that the United States is respected. And I think that's the risk that we face today in a debate that we're having and will have through the 2008 election, whether the United States, when it makes a commitment, can be counted on to fulfill it or not. And I think if the public opinion polls are viewed as bad today, imagine how much worse they'll be if people see the United States as fickle and undependable.
Ambassador Bolton, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
John Bolton, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he joined us today. When we come back from a short break, turnout at today's immigration marches is down from last year. Gustavo Arellano argues that's not a sign of frustration, but a sign of Latino success. We'll talk with him when we come back and take your calls. Is the struggle for immigration reform almost over? Is there no more need to march? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. This is NPR News.